Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, it's the new year. It's time to head into 2016. And as we've done for the last several years, we'll make some resolutions for the next 12 months and give you an update on our performance on last year's efforts. We'll also make a few predictions for 2016, and we'll update last year's version of that segment as well. Embarrassing. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
We just want to take a moment to thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour, whether you're new to the show or you've been joining us for years. We also want to toss out a quick reminder about the wide world of NPR podcasts. When you're ready for some alone time during the holiday season, we have so much for you to check out. Comedy and culture, creative storytelling, and insights into politics, the economy, and the hidden forces that shape us. Whether you're sharing NPR podcasts with your family or squirreling them away for yourselves, you can listen now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
The new year is strongly in our minds, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us this week in our fourth chair, back for her second consecutive Resolutions and Predictions show, is Kat Chow. Kat, what do you do at NPR?
I'm a writer for NPR's Code Switch.
Well, it's wonderful to have you with us. We thought that it would be fitting to have Kat here, as Kat was here last year, and that brings the perfect flavor of accountability.
That's right.
My
one of the things, of the things that we're here for. Now, we're going to talk about our resolutions first. Every year at this time, we take a moment to engage in the often fruitless but occasionally edifying ritual of resolution making. Specifically, we make resolutions about our relationships to popular culture and some of the things that we want to read or listen to or watch in the year to come. And before we do that, we do feel like it's only fair to turn back the clock and consider the resolutions that we made last year at this time. Spoiler alert, this can often be a very depressing exercise, but we're going to do it anyway. I'm going to go Stephen first because he's my pal and he'll forgive me for going to him first.
So I get sand kicked in my face first.
By time,
the sands of time kicked in my face.
Absolutely.
First promise, I will not get a DVR. I will probably not embrace the cloud. I will not sit still and enjoy entertainment on its own. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we've got personal resolutions and pop culture ones. For me, my personal resolution is I do intend to quit drinking Diet Coke once and for all and to switch to something that is more water-based, something that is better for my nerves and innards.
Gotcha.
Wonderful.
So this is a resolution that might be familiar to Glenn Weldon. You know, we've talked in the past about how I don't read a lot of books, and that's another thing that I don't want to say I've given up on it because I do believe that I will start picking up books, but I'm going to stop promising that I'm going to pick up
books.
Good. But I want to get back into writing them. Mm-hmm. I used to edit a lot of books when I worked at The Onion. I worked on a lot of these comedy books as a copy editor. I edited a book of interviews called The Tenacity of the Cockroach for the AV Club, and I really liked doing that stuff. Now, that's how I got out of the habit of reading books in the first place, was spending too much time writing them. But I think if I'm not going to become the person I want to be who reads books, I want to at least get back into the craft of writing them. It occurred to me that, like, I'd really like to try working on books now that the book industry has collapsed.
Yeah, good timing.
And I want to try my hand at selling way fewer of them.
That's cool.
Wow, I was doing so well for a little while there. I mean, I was just rattling off things that...
So tick it off.
Things that actually happened.
Tick them off.
I did not get a DVR. Mm-hmm. I did not put my stuff in the cloud. I don't particularly want to put my stuff in the cloud anymore. I am very happy with those very easy promises. I did
to not do things.
Promising to not do things.
I promise stasis.
Uh-huh. I did quit Diet Coke.
Yes. You did.
It took until mid-September, but I have not had a drop of the stuff.
So, what's your water-based alternative?
Sparkling water. Bought myself a soda. Well, I was given a soda stream.
Nice.
So I'm drinking a little sparkling water, trying to drink more regular water, hydrating better. Of course, I quit Diet Coke, and it took only about 6 weeks to contract pneumonia. But I think that the two...
Definite correlation.
That the two are unrelated, and I'm delighted to be living a largely vice-free existence. However, I did not write a book.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I not only failed to write a book, I failed to seize the opportunity presented to me on January 9th when my literary agent, having heard the episode of the show where I talked about wanting to write a book, wrote me an email that said, "Did someone say book writing?"
Mm-hmm.
And then 357 days later, nothing has happened so far.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So 3 out of 4.
Uplifting.
So you did good on some of those things, though.
Yes.
You did quit Diet Coke. I'm proud of you for that one.
But
buddy.
That's not so much a cultural thing.
No,
it really isn't.
That's really hard, though. You were going through a lot
really
of
hard.
Diet Coke.
You do look a little bit less frazzled when you're not carrying around a 2-liter bottle of Diet Coke.
Just as a general rule, yeah.
My pallor isn't quite so gray, I'm sure.
So what is it for this year?
Well, on the personal front, my big thing is I want to give stuff away. I want to subtract. I want to accumulate fewer CDs, kind of make that digital switch and try to get sort of leaner and meaner around the house. And also just like give stuff away from a standpoint of trying to put a little bit of good into the world and put a little bit of clutter into other people's homes.
Mm-hmm.
On the professional level, of course, I would still like to write that book. But
mm-hmm.
if I don't, I at least still want to write and create more. I want to launch new stuff and sort of set aside larger blocks of time with figurative blank sheets of paper and more time to fill them. I'm actually work-wise trying to shuffle things around to focus more energy on the writing and talking and less time on the editing and futzing around with things that are not necessarily entirely creative pursuits. So output is kind of my big watchword for 2016. I want to be a better pen pal. I want to just be in the practice of writing and communicating more. And one way to get to that point is I really, really, really want to try, and this is difficult to measure, but I want to spend less of my spare time marinating in the internet, and particularly the grievance-based corners of the internet. 2016 is an election year. It's very easy to get sucked into that. I want to do that turning off the router thing and devote as much energy as possible to creating rather than spending so much energy, like I said, marinating in grievances and other things that happen. So, you know, a lot of just like producing, but also taking more time to really enjoy pop culture. Like, I want to really bust out the old turntable a little bit more, get a few more iPod docs, spend more time living my life around the house with music and art and things that I enjoy.
I like that.
Very good.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Stephen. All right, Glenn Weldon, let's hear what it was last year.
Okay. What's happened is I've fallen out of the lifelong habit of reading. It's very difficult to fall out of a lifelong habit, so I was trying to figure out why that happened, how that happened. You know what it is? It's podcasts. The amount, the sheer number and amount of podcasts that I listen to are giving me some of the pleasure that I got from reading. Because reading used to be the thing I would do when I wasn't doing anything else. It's, before I went to bed, on commutes. Now that time is used up by listening to podcasts. Here's another thing. Similarly, writing dumb dad jokes on Twitter feels like writing. It isn't writing.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like comedy. It isn't comedy. Unlike stand-up comedy, it risks nothing. You're not putting yourself out there, and the writing goes away. It vanishes. But it makes your brain thinks you've just written something, when in fact, all you've done is made a dumb dad joke on Twitter. So I'm not going to go cold turkey, because I get a lot of pleasure out of podcasts and out of Twitter, still do. I'll go lukewarm meatloaf on those two things. And I will commit, because a thing that's been lacking on this show in our resolutions and our predictions are metrics.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a metric. I'm going to read a book a week this year. 52 books. Now, that is far off my peak. I'm not going to stipulate what kind of books. Just going to say books. Okay, so
wow.
Let's summarize. Less listening to podcasts. It didn't happen. Whenever I would excise one from the feed, another one would sneak in. That's just the way that happens. Less tweeting dumb, hacky dad
I
jokes.
I love your tweets, though.
Well, you're a kind person, but nope, that just kept up. Because I do get, like, a little dopamine hit.
Of course
you know,
you do.
It's dumb, but I do. More writing, that didn't so much happen because I lack, you know, grit, determination, sure. character, things like that. I don't have it. And more reading. So I'm 1 for 4 because I did read more than 52 books this year. Now, you know, a good third of them were graphic novels or comics. Mm-hmm. That counts. Books are books are books.
But you also read all those book award books?
That's right.
I did read,
that's a lot.
I did read 16 books in 1 weekend. That kind of pushed me over the top.
One week.
That helped. Yep. So, yeah, so it's not
one
bad.
For
One for four. 25%.
All right.
Grade.
So what for this year?
For this year, well, you're going to notice something in both my choices for my resolution and for my prediction. The watchword is boldness. I'm making a lot of bold choices this year. No half measures. I'm going to make a lot of bold, muscular, musk-scented choices.
Musk-scented choices.
What does that mean?
That means, for example, I'm going to do a thing that I have avoided all my life. I love games. I love video games, but I have never really gone online with video games. Mm-hmm. But this year, I think I'm actually going to do it because I did get this game called Star Wars Battlefront, which has a campaign, which has a section that you can play by yourself, but it is a mighty thin gruel compared to what's going on online, all these giant maps and things you can do. So despite... It does feel like being in a kiddie pool, splashing around in a kiddie pool right next to the ocean, the turbid, roiling, misogynistic, homophobic, racist ocean. But I'm going to jump in with both feet. I'm going to get myself a headset.
Well, like everything else, there's corners of that. Right. But there's also plenty of lovely, wonderful people,
that's
as you
right.
know, or you wouldn't be doing it.
So I'm going to do it. This is what I mean about bold. I'm going to frag. I'm going to snipe. I'm going to camp the respawn.
I'm gonna
dual wield in CQB.
Yeah,
I'm gonna
impressive.
Nerf the flange. I'm gonna have to look up some more.
I have to Google all this.
But
later.
this is what I'm gonna do.
All right, that sounds good.
Yep.
That sounds good. I will take it. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. All right, Kat. Since we brought you back here, we have to hear your resolution from last year.
I realized when I was thinking about me in the past 20-something years of my life, I've never really been a super fan of anything. Mm. And I was thinking, well, what is possibly the closest thing? And I realized Michael B. Jordan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, wow, there you go.
Okay,
good choice.
I finally finished Friday Night Lights.
Good for you.
I know. Yeah, we should talk about
that
at some other point. One thing that stuck out was Michael B. Jordan's performance. And then I kind of walked back and realized, okay, he was also in Fruitvale Station, mm-hmm. which was my first encounter with him, where everyone was saying, oh, yeah, he was so good in The Wire. He was mm-hmm. so good in Friday Night Lights. A couple weeks ago, I started watching The Wire. Oh my gosh, I cried.
Yeah.
That first season.
Yes.
But also, he's apparently in Parenthood, which I kind of watched a couple episodes of. It's streaming on Netflix. So Michael B. Jordan, as weird as it is to make a person be the object of my fandom, that can happen. And then also, another thing that I think I would like to start exploring are Korean dramas. I always hear a lot of people on Twitter talking about the different K-dramas that they're watching or getting into. I want to just try out a couple, at least, and actually give it a full run, watch a whole series, watch mm-hmm. two whole series, and see what the whole buzz is.
Okay. So, did you deep dive into the world of Michael B. Jordan?
Okay, well, first of all, I think, to backtrack a little bit, mm-hmm. so last year, my sense from you guys was it is not a good thing to have tangible goals. And this year, I really realized that. That is so true because I kind of put myself into a really bad corner. So the Michael B. Jordan thing, that was a really bad, 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 horrible idea.
Because,
why? Because Parenthood. I decided to start watching Parenthood.
Oh, sure.
That show is so long. I think it's 5 seasons long. And Michael B. Jordan is only in 16 episodes. Like, Ray Romano is in more episodes than Michael B. Jordan.
But you only have to watch the 16 that he's...
No, I committed because I was like, okay. See.
Okay,
no,
here's... This is going to determine how committed you are to this idea. Did you see Fantastic Four?
No.
Okay.
So I was doing one thing at a time.
Right.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to watch Parenthood, which took me 3 months to get through the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that's all I did mm-hmm. when I went home from work. And I mean...
So you still have to see Fantastic Four.
Yes.
You still have to see That Awkward Moment.
Yes, Ooh, That Awkward boy. Moment. I think I could actually do that.
And yeah. you should see Creed, because Creed's good.
I was going to say, have you seen Creed?
I heard Creed was very good.
Creed's very good.
So last year I was all about the super fandom thing, and now I'm just realizing it's not really my thing. I'm going to just let these things happen organically. And then as for the Korean drama thing, so right after I talked about how I wanted to start getting into that last year, a friend, Joanna, she sent me this really obsessive spreadsheet that she made where she had compiled all of these K-dramas. And I don't know, I think she broke it out in themes and rated them and had a very specific system. And I decided to go for the show that was most easily accessible, called Coffee Prince.
Okay.
And mm-hmm. It's basically like Twelfth Night. Or also, it's like that Amanda Bynes movie, She's the Man, where you have this protagonist who's pretending to be a different gender to do a thing. And then, of course, there's like this hunky, well-off guy who mm-hmm. doesn't realize that she's a woman. And they have this kind of like sexual tension, but it
sure.
can't ever be.
Right, sure.
Yeah. So a gender bending.
But you
thing.
Did it. But you did it.
I did. I don't remember any of it. I mean, I think I half did
but
it.
But you tried it.
I did try it. And
you're so far ahead of where we usually wind up with our
relationship. I just don't see myself ever picking up another one again, which
really?
Is fine.
That's okay.
Yeah.
What's on the docket for this year?
Okay, so this year, something less goal-oriented. They're all kind of more personal. Like, I want to teach my dad how to stream things on the internet.
That's cool.
Like, how to use Netflix, how mm-hmm. to go on Amazon
Sharing
Prime.
Is part of culture.
Yeah, because I think there are a lot of shows that he would maybe be interested in, like Man in the High Castle. But every time I talk about these shows, he's always like, I don't know. I don't know how to use Netflix.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But like, if he can use Yahoo Mail's interface, I'm
yes.
pretty sure
yeah.
he can like click on
he
a button.
He can figure it out.
I always feel like the Mendoza line for ability to catch on to that stuff is me okay. and whether I can do it, and even I can do Netflix.
Even, but I don't know, you haven't met Mr. Chow. maybe you should. Yeah. No, so he's on another level. And then personally, like what you guys have been saying about, I don't know, being more creative, I want to write more. But I think with me, I've always been a little afraid to write and be a bit bold with my writing and kind of go a more personal route. I find myself being very tentative, and I just don't, I'm tired of that. I don't want to yeah. do that. So I want to just put myself out there and take more risks, because that's okay. And what's going to happen? Am I going to get yelled at on the internet? That happens already.
Yep.
So yes, this is for me branching out, putting more of myself on the line, maybe trying my hand at more fiction. And by more, I mean fiction in general,
mm-hmm.
More personal essays, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
Wonderful.
Right. Nice.
Yeah. Good to hear. So you, like Stephen, are focusing on your output
yes.
This year.
Yes.
That sounds good. I hope that happens and I'll read all of it. All right. My resolution from last year. Let's see what it was. On the personal side, and I've been telling this to everyone who will listen and many people who don't want to listen, it is to sleep more. I have suddenly started forcing myself to get an adequate amount of sleep, partly after seeing an incredibly terrifying Nat Geo special about people not getting enough sleep. So thanks to Nat Geo for that. Stephen took one of mine, which is I want to think about books and writing something and mm-hmm. all that business. I'm supposed to be doing that, and I want to be working on that. And I want to continue with something that had been a 2013 resolution that I definitely did, and then I did not have it in the docket for this past year, but I'm going to put it back on the docket again, which is to continue to seek out work by people whose work I don't already know. So last thing first, I definitely did that. I definitely did seek out work by people whose work I didn't know, although, again, I did not put a metric on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little hard to quantify, but I do feel like I did that. I will get back to that in a second because I'm going to put a metric on it for next year. Oh, book thing. No. Frankly, this year was a year of keeping my head above water in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to get out of that mode, but it was not a year in which I took on, aside from the things that kind of were officially part of work, it was not something where there was a lot of exploratory other stuff going on. Sleeping more, wow, that was really good while I was doing it. It was really, really, really helpful.
From January 1st to January 6th.
No, it was like until the end of March. And then it's just I got busy and life got nuts, and it's one of those things where eventually I just start waking up at 4 a.m. and I can't do anything about it. And I don't know. It's still an area of interest because I do recommend it as far as like everything went better when I was doing that. So I'm trying to get back to it. But it's also really hard to do by force.
Yeah.
Sleep is one of those terrible, terrible things. Anyway, for this year, it's sort of similar stuff that I've talked about before. It's always books and it's always trying to find new people, but I feel like I have to put some structure around those things. So Glenn was very ambitious and said a book a week and wildly overachieved in that regard. I'm going to be less ambitious. I'm going to say one book a month, but one book a month that is not something that I am reading for pleasure that I would naturally pick up, but something that, well, not for pleasure, but, you know, something that I am reading because I think it will be challenging and interesting and different. So I'm going to do that. That's on my list. And then I'm going to try to explore somebody's work or music or writing or whatever every week. New person every week, new book every month. That's my plan. We'll see how it goes. I'm going to try to keep track. That's the resolution for 2016. Similar stuff, but more structure. And actually trying to follow one of these book ones is the way that I wound up reading some good books at one point. So I am enthusiastic about that, and I'm trying to do it. So.
Can I back up? This is going to be a tangent, but let's see if it works.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, I made another resolution that only intersects pop culture tangentially, obliquely, mm-hmm. and that was to eat less and exercise more. And I have stuck to that.
Yeah, you did.
Not mm-hmm. because of fitness. Who cares about fitness? Not because of health. Health. But because I knew that my publisher was demanding an author photo.
Oh, yeah.
And,
oh.
The book's about nerds. The book's about pop culture. And I just wanted people who are picking up the book for the first time who had no idea who I was to look at that author photo and not think to themselves, Simpsons comic book guy wrote this book, right. Which is kind of where I was headed. So through a 4-part plan, which I will share with listeners now and make a mint, I managed to lose, who keeps track? I don't know, 80 pounds. Step one, joyless salads. Step two, grueling exercise. Uh-huh. Step three, self-loathing. Mm-hmm. A lot of people skimp on the self-loathing, mm-hmm. but it's very, very important. And four, mm-hmm. finally, basically denying yourself everything that makes life worth living.
Yeah.
You just do those four things, you know, forever, for the rest of your miserable barbecue potato chip-less life,
uh-huh.
and the pounds and inches melt away.
Sounds
that's my great. That's my tip.
Wow.
Meet y'all.
But that author photo is
happy holidays.
Great. All wow. right.
You are much less reluctant to do promotional photos for this show, I have found.
That's certainly true.
Absolutely true. Well, when we come back, we're going to move on to the other part of this show, which is when we get into our predictions for next year and also, of course, checking out our predictions from last year. So stick around.
Support for this podcast comes from American Crime on ABC, from Oscar winner and executive producer John Ridley. In a private high school, the sexual assault of one male student will affect the lives of so many people. It's an emotional new story of class, family, and modern American issues. The critically acclaimed and Golden Globe-nominated series stars Felicity Huffman, Timothy Hutton, Lily Taylor, and Regina King. American Crime, season premiere Wednesday, January 6th at 10, 9 Central on ABC.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. In the first half of our show, we did our resolutions for next year. Now we're going to move on to predictions. Now, before we get to predictions for this year, we're going to do exactly the same thing and check out briefly predictions from last year. Stephen, I want to hear your prediction from last year.
I feel like 2015 is going to be a year where we have this conversation a year from now. We will have had many conversations about juggernaut fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about this from the standpoint of movies, which is fairly obvious, and from music a little less so. In the movies, you've got your Star Wars sequel, you've got your
Avengers
Age of Ultron, which if that doesn't make $1 billion is mm-hmm. going to be a disastrous problem. We're just going to be lurching from blockbuster to blockbuster, I think more than usual in movies. Now, in terms of music, what I feel like we're going to see happen is a bit of a shift toward a bigger sound, a more of a rock sound. looking at what we're going to be seeing in 2015, even just looking at the docket for the next few months, there's a new Sleater-Kinney record. There's this band called Screaming Females that I think is going to be big, awesome, just rock and roll record. You're going to see a new record by Modest Mouse, which is like a bigger sounding rock band. There are supposed to be these long-awaited, just big rock juggernaut records from Van Halen and Tool and, who hasn't put out a record in ages, and even Faith No More, I guess, is supposed to put out an album in 2015. And I think you're going to see a little bit more of a shift, even like Kanye West putting out a new record. Like Kanye West, the Yeezus record is a big, loud, mm-hmm. abrasive record mm-hmm. that I would consider like a rock record in its own way.
Yeah.
It's produced very much from a rock mindset. And I think everything is going to feel bigger. The other thing is I predict a very rocky launch of the Stephen Colbert as a network late night host.
Interesting.
I had so many opportunities while that tape was playing to just shake my head like, nope. The number of albums I assumed would come out that never came out is really pretty impressive. No Van Halen record, no Tool record, no Kanye West record. And I don't know that I would say that guitars and big rock and roll has really made a gigantic comeback, at least in your pop MTV world. There were certainly some big rock records throughout the year. So I think that was pretty much a swing and a miss.
And do you guys feel like this year was one of blockbuster after blockbuster after blockbuster? It doesn't feel like that now at the end of December.
I also think that was kind of a whiff. I would maybe, as we talk about 2016,
yeah.
I think there's a way of pushing that one forward a little bit. I think there were several pieces of entertainment in 2015 that I think felt compulsory in a way. Your Jurassic World, it was like everyone just had to see it apparently because it made $600 million. Mm-hmm. And Star Wars The Force Awakens certainly qualifies as a compulsory movie. The Adele record, mm-hmm. which, you know, it sold, you know, millions and millions of copies in its first few weeks, kind of regardless of what people even thought of it. But I don't necessarily feel like we're sitting here like, oh my God, thank goodness this year of massive juggernauts is over. So I think those were largely whiff. And then with the Stephen Colbert, I think I actually kind of got that one a little bit.
That I would say very rocky, but I don't know that it's been like blissful and perfect.
Mm-hmm. I think the metric I used at some point in that discussion was, I'm not saying that people are going to be talking about canceling it. I'm not saying that it's the Chevy Chase show, but I think that the transition is going to be tougher than people realize. And I probably overstated that even a little bit, but that has not been as smooth sailing as I think a lot of people thought. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kind of like one half of one out of three.
So hit me for this year.
All right. I think I will come down with a terrible illness the week that Batman versus Superman comes out. The name of this sickness will have a Latin name that roughly translates to I don't wanna.
Mm-hmm.
A long-awaited sequel will dominate the first quarter of 2016 like no other. I'm speaking, of course, of Kung Fu Panda 3.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You are really tired of me talking about Kung Fu Panda, aren't you, Linda?
Wow.
I think there will be fewer of these like long-awaited band reunions that we keep getting, mostly because there are no bands left to reunite. Mm-hmm. Take hot tip. I think when we're talking about the Tonys, might hear about a little production called Hamilton.
The Maybe. Devil you say.
Hamilton.
Those are some hot takes.
Waiting around on a lot.
Maybe
a few
more actual predictions here. We'll go with, I predict that three of the top 10 highest grossing films of 2016 will be big, uproarious, escapist comedies. Kind of akin to like a There's Something About Mary. Silly, goofy, big, maybe gross out comedies as a hallmark of how exhausted people are by just the sheer weight of the world. That in a kind of bruising election year with lots of, it feels like it's going to be, and I know every time at the end of the year I talk about how exhausted everybody's going to be because that's maybe how I feel at the end of the year. But I think you are going to see a big rise in and a big embrace of big, silly, stupid movies that I think is going to come out as like, that's where your surprise hits are going to come from. Mm-hmm. And that maybe your grim and gritty Batman versus Superman stuff is not as much what people are hungry for. I predict a little bit of like comparative disappointment around Finding Dory. I'm going to predict that
Finding Nemo sequel.
The Finding Nemo sequel. I'm going to predict that it is not one of the highest grossing movies of 2016. What seems like a sure thing is going to bring about a little bit more discussion. Even after Inside Out, obviously, was this wonderful, wonderful movie in 2015. You had The Good Dinosaur. I think people are going to start talking like, oh, no, maybe Pixar has maybe lost its way.
Yeah.
Finally, straight up Grammy prediction, Album of the Year. Everyone is viewing the Album of the Year Grammy as this battle royale between Taylor Swift and Kendrick Lamar. We'll talk about the Grammys on this show. Vegas is giving it 7-1 odds. The Album of the Year, Alabama Shakes.
As your
Grammy-approved rock band that everyone can agree on.
Cool. All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. All right, Glenn, before we get to your new prediction, we're going to go back
bold.
To your old
Remember
prediction.
I said bold?
Bold.
Last year was bold, too.
Bold, too.
On February 6, a film called Jupiter Ascending comes out by the Wachowskis. It's not based on any pre-existing property at all. It's just coming straight from the Wachowskis' tortured brains. And what it has going for it is that the Wachowskis make idiosyncratic films,
yeah,
let's put it that way. And the thing that they do uniquely is they make idiosyncratic, huge, expensive films.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So their vision is huge,
right.
And it's big. So, and any film that doubles down on the special effects as much as this film is, I mean, there's a certain kind of critic out there who professes a fondness for, you know, glacial existential dramas set in war-torn Finland,
yeah.
You know, the Winter of My Despondency, those kind of films.
I know some of those guys.
Right. They're going to hate it. They are sharpening their knives like it's a roast beast. And I am going to say, here's my prediction. In defiance of all laws of God and man and box office mojo, this film, top 10 film of 2015.
Wow.
Makes over $200 million.
Wow. Love it.
That's my prediction.
Love
bold.
It.
I am
Love it.
Foolhardy.
Love
I,
it.
I got nothing to lose. It's better to burn out than fade away.
I like it.
I'm doubling down on this. I think it's going to be dumb. But I think it's going to work.
It's bold.
Bold. Say the word, the very word.
Bold.
You heard our admiration.
Yeah, well, I might have missed
we
it by a
hair. We should place money on these bets.
A hair? I might have missed it. But look, I flew too close to the sun.
How much did it make?
I don't know.
Let's just say it was more than $200 million.
More than $200 million. Look, it tried something. It wasn't like everything else out there. I stand by the fact that it was big and dumb.
Absolutely.
And committed to the bit.
I was just telling somebody the other day, I think that movie is significantly better than its reputation for being not worth anything.
Yep. Right.
I think that movie has its charms.
It is as
but
we
it
have...
did not make a gigantic, unreal amount
Very
of money.
Very much did not.
It is, as we have described other movies in the past, a noble failure.
Yes.
I think that's fair. All right, buddy. So what's up for this year?
Well, I'm going to go just as bold,
just
if not
bold.
More so.
If not more so.
There is a small indie art house film coming out that I'm going to love. And the name of that film is Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. Oh, look at the expression on your face. You're surprised. See? Bold. I'm saying bold.
That's what I mean. You're not going to love this. You already hate this movie.
You are going to love it on what
basis? This is what I mean. This is exactly what I wanted. For me to say this looks terrible would be predictable, and that's not what I'm doing. It would not be surprising if I said that this is surprising. Why? Okay, now granted, this movie
going
looks...
for the element of surprise in terms of... Never mind, go ahead.
I'm going bold, unpredictable...
this is like announcing there's going to be a licorice-flavored Tootsie Roll.
<I know. laughs>
It's going to be your favorite new snack.
Bold.
Look, it is grim and gritty. It is a 90s comic book come to life. It features Doomsday, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the epitome of the blunt, dull-witted, ultraviolet, spectacle over storytelling thing that overtook comics in the 90s and chased me out of comics. It is a film, think about this, that is relying for its comic relief on Jesse Eisenberg. That guy is the grumpy cat of actors. That guy is humorless, and he's carrying...
Oh, no, he's funny in Adventureland.
He was good in Adventureland, but he's not... So much is riding on his shoulders. He's going to be the only jokes in this mm-hmm. film. But it was a critic, Gray McMillan, in Hollywood Reporter, who pointed out that there is a scene in the trailer in which Batman and a bunch of other folks are tied up in a underground bunker. Superman arrives, filled with rage. Soldiers that he's somehow commissioned bow down to him and blah, 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 grim and gritty, which is wildly out of character. And the reason, as Stephen was saying before a few weeks back, about how when you feel a strong revulsion, you feel like you need to jump onto Twitter and chronicle it,
right.
And then you need to walk it back. I went on and said this film should be called Failure of Imagination, the movie. But Graham McMillan pointed out that Silver Age comics had covers where you would see Superman doing something wildly out of character all the time with a legend, not a hoax, not an imaginary story, not a dream, just to get kids to open the thing up. And if that's what Snyder is doing here, leading with that, just to play with our expectations, I would take my hat off to him if I wore hats, which I don't. But still, I mean, go for it. Do it. So I reserve the right to be pleasantly surprised by this film.
Well, you always had the right to be pleasantly surprised,
but you're saying you're going to. I'm not sure that what you are laying out here is a prediction.
Predicting I'm going to like it. Boom. There.
Wow.
Okay. That's bold, buddy.
Bold, right?
Licorice-flavored really Tootsie Rolls.
Yes, it will.
That is what you were saying you will love.
Yes.
That is bold as all heck.
Mm-hmm.
I am proud of you, pal.
There we go.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. All right, Kat. We got to go back and look at Kat's prediction for 2015.
So in 2015, I think that Fresh Off the Boat is going to make some serious, serious waves. I know that at least there's going to be some great discussion about it and more representation of Asian American actors. And maybe it'll be the year of the Asian American male on screen.
Cool. Are you predicting success or you're predicting that it's going to be good? Two different things.
I think that I'm predicting that it's going to be a slow boil.
Okay.
I don't know if it's going to become mainstream enough so that everyone's going to watch it. But I mean, I already know that there's going to be a niche audience.
Mm-hmm.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
I think that's the case.
Did pretty good.
I think so. And I mean, I remember last year I was kind of hesitant to say if it would be good right off the bat because there were so many questions about Fresh
Off
the Boat.
It was early.
Yeah. People were concerned about the accents. People were concerned about like a ton of other things.
And Eddie Huang at that time was still very much kind of being dubious and talking about how it wasn't really what he wanted and all that stuff.
Right, right. And I think that like even if you just look at the trajectory of the first season and now the second season, the jokes and the things that they reach for are so much more pointed. So like in the first episode, the main joke was like, oh, Eddie Huang, the actual character, he goes to sit in the cafeteria and gets made fun of for the food that he brings. And like someone calls his noodles worms. And like that's stuff that, you know, kids of immigrants could relate to. But now it's getting so much more meta. So it kind of evolves. In a later episode that happened about a month or so ago, Randall Park's character, Lewis, gets to have an opportunity to go on the local TV station. And his wife, Jessica, who's played by Constance Wu, she gets really on him, where she says something like, you know, we don't get opportunities to be on TV. Like, that's why when we do, we have to make sure that they're really good. And eventually he says something to the effect of, like, you know, doing this, doing everything so well, it's impossible. And I think that's kind of what happened with Fresh Off the Boat, where they became as much of the conversation within the show.
Mm-hmm.
As for the thing about the year of the Asian American male, that was so right. Like, I didn't even know that Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt would be around, featuring Ki Hong Lee, who played the character Dong. Ken Jeong had his show, and then Master of None with Kelvin Yu, with Ravi Patel and Aziz himself. And so there was just that big evolution. And like what I've talked about a lot before is how for a lot of minority groups or people who don't have that much representation on TV, there's always that worry about the burden of like even just like what I was talking about with that Fresh Off the Boat scene where everybody is so worried and everything feels so fraught about how there's not enough. And so there's so much more weight on this one character to be everything. And I think that the great thing about having more Asian American men, which is so specific, allows us to have a range. So not everything has to be so good.
Absolutely.
And I really like seeing that. But the character that I think emerged as being one of the strongest wasn't Hudson Yang. It wasn't Randall Park. They were great. But it was Constance Wu.
Absolutely. I think she's the person who's gotten the most attention,
right,
for sure.
Right, right. She made her character into something, I mean, maybe not necessarily real, but really relatable.
And so specific and funny.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
And even outside of the show, just her as a real person, one of my sisters was talking to me about how, in a way, like she wishes that she was more like Constance Wu, which is something that I haven't heard my sister ever say. And because also it never felt like there was an opportunity for my sister to say that about an Asian American woman who was similar to her age, who, you know, was speaking profoundly about what it is like to be an Asian American woman on screen.
Yeah. All right, I want to hear your predictions for this year.
Okay, so I predict that HGTV is going to step more toward building out their hosts' narratives, like their personal narratives, in a very meaningful way. So Fixer Upper, which is Linda's giving me a look.
No, I love this.
Okay,
so, I love this. Go on.
You're okay, so specific. This is good.
That's why I love it. Because I've been. This is all I thought about when I was in Dallas. Because all I did was watch Fixer Upper. Because Waco, Texas, was only like 90 minutes from where I was, and every single day I kept thinking, "What if I just drove down to Waco, Texas, where that show Fixer Upper is filmed, and I just like." I don't know. Bought a house there.
Bought a house.
Uh-huh. Was a contestant on the show. Well, not a contestant. Was a participant on the show. Why that show works to me is because you have these two adorable hosts. You have Chip and JoJo.
All right.
And they have, like, this very Waco life. And it doesn't feel at all manufactured where, like, they're making fun of each other on camera. And it's very much a departure from the, like, Property Virgins-esque, House Hunter-esque mm-hmm. type of thing. Or even, like, Love It or List It, which I have really grown to dislike.
And it's a warmer and fuzzier host narrative.
Yes, and it feels like a relationship that you really aspire to have. For HGTV in general, home buying and home improvement is really aspirational because, like, you're actually improving something. But to also inject that really human part where it's more about personal relationships is so smart. And we've already seen that trend with with Property Brothers.
So your prediction is that HGTV is going to continue to follow this mold of, like, making the hosts more accessible and personal, and that whole, like, super powerful basic cable brand is going to get more voicey and less kind of like...
Right. I don't think they're going to move away from, like, the House Hunters... offshoots like the Tiny House Hunters and stuff like that. But I think that we're going to see, like, more of Drew and Jonathan Scott and, like, they're at home on the ranch, whatever, which I binge watched.
More like Barefoot Contestants.
Right? Yeah.
That makes sense to me.
That's
this
interesting
holds up.
Because they have moved away from the whole, you know, the host of Trading Spaces being such so in the mix and all the people in Trading Spaces.
But that was
so
TLC, much, though.
It was TLC, yeah. right? Yeah. But I'm saying this: there's a trend in home improvement television away. There has been a trend in home improvement television away from forefronting the host and forefronting this nebulous voice that says, Jackie and Tim want a place on the Caribbean. Like that kind of thing.
Right.
And now that's a bold.
Yes.
And good prediction.
I will also make one more prediction that I just came up with now. And so I'm a little wishy-washy on this. So I think they will have a non-white host and that they will try and bring up that narrative. I kind of think maybe HGTV sees the value in reaching a different audience. And so maybe they're going to expand.
Very nice.
Cool.
Yes.
Very good. I like it. All right. Thank you very much, Kat Chow. So my prediction, when I went back to listen to my prediction for last year, I realized that I had typed it out as an angry rant and then read it, which you will be able to tell when you hear me read it. What I predict is that for the most part, large entertainment companies will continue to feature and reward the same people they always have. You will still see mostly prestige movies by white guy directors about white people. You will still see a lack of representation both behind the scenes and in front of the camera, both in movies and on television. I predict that progress will be continuous but maddeningly incremental. I predict that the diversity of the entertainment that you consume will continue to be, as it is now, largely a function of how willing you are to seek out more than just what's most heavily and extravagantly marketed. I predict that a significant part of the cultural conversation will continue to revolve around efforts to define other people's tastes out of existence or out of respectability, which means having a mind of your own will continue to require a high tolerance for scolding. Now, the good way to look at these kind of dire feelings that I sometimes have when I look at the difficulty that we have making change in culture is that it is still going to be necessary for people to seek out, and I do think it is easier to seek out than it ever has been, the things that you want to find that are different, that are interesting. And I think one of the mandates of projects like the blog that I write and also of the show, and one of the reasons we do What's Making You Happy this week, is to try to find those things that, you know, maybe people haven't seen, maybe people haven't heard of. But it is going to continue to be a sort of every person for themselves, I think, battle to find the things that are worth really loving, because there is no sea change toward all of a sudden it's all very democratic and meritocracy. And so if you want a concrete prediction, The Imitation Game wins Best Picture.
Yeah.
Because that's just kind of what happens. And that just feels like it's kind of the most predictable thing that could possibly happen.
But I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to predict that Ava DuVernay will win Best Director. And then everyone will be like, problem solved.
Yeah. That'd be interesting if it happened. I would be surprised if that happened, but I know exactly what you're talking about. I don't mean to make it such a downer prediction. It's just that if I'm talking about actual predictions, what I actually think is going to happen, I cannot possibly claim that I think anything is going to happen except a lot more of the same and a struggle to get to anything different.
I like the fact that I jumped into your prediction to be spectacularly wrong.
Oh, right.
To go out on a limb.
Of course, Imitation Game did not win. Birdman won, which I don't know that I found that much more satisfying. But it is true that Birdman is a little more experimental as a movie and a little less obvious than Imitation Game. I would stand by the incremental progress part. I think what Kat pointed out, I think it has been a good year, particularly on television. I think it has been a good year for kind of family shows. Empire has been helpful in opening up as part of a kind of longer process of smartening up television networks as far as broadening their audiences. I think Shonda Rhimes, the Shondaland shows and all that stuff, and Empire and Blackish and Fresh Off the Boat and The Wiz, which they just did. And I do think they're getting to the point where they're getting a little smarter about that. But it does still feel to me maddeningly incremental. Yeah. And I feel like we have these years where people say, like, you're the woman, you're the whatever. And then you go back and look at the actual numbers, and it's always maddeningly incremental. Yeah. So I stand by maddeningly incremental, although I do believe Blackish and Fresh Off the Boat and Empire, the progress that they all made in 2015, whether they actually premiered that year or not, I think the progress that all those shows made, along with the other stuff that we talked about, has definitely been some progress.
Well, and looking at the Best Picture Z type movies for the Oscars, the things that are likely to be nominated in a few weeks, it is not entirely movies about dudes.
Yeah, but it's still, you know.
It's not. We get like 6 out of 8.
Again, it's incremental. Anyway, so in terms of prediction for this year, I'm a little more concrete and feet on the ground. I have a very specific thing that I'm going to predict this year, which relates to something that I've talked about a bunch of times. I predict that during 2016, Netflix is going to start to make some kind of information about viewing available, which they have really resisted doing. They have really resisted telling you how many people watch anything, which has resulted in them being able to kind of say, like, this is a huge hit. And then they don't tell you who watches anything. Now, the traditional idea of this has been they don't have any reason to.
Right.
Because they don't rely on ratings, so they don't need ad sales. And why would you tell when it might just reveal that certain things aren't doing as well as you think?
Yeah.
The issue, I think, is going to be they're going to face increasing competition from other streaming services. When you have competition from other streaming services, it starts to be more difficult to position yourself. For one thing, when you're in competition with like Hulu or whoever to pick up more shows, and you're trying to figure out like what you should pay, everybody kind of wants to understand a little bit more and is willing to do a little more digging around into kind of like what kind of contract are you trying to make and how many people really are watching and what's the value. And actors are starting to talk a little bit about people needing to know the basics of this in order to be able to negotiate. There's a really interesting piece in Vulture as part of the week of features they did about ratings, which is all really interesting, in which they asked a bunch of people to talk about ratings. And Adam Pally, the actor, talked about how it's hard for people to negotiate when they don't know anything about how many people are watching. I think there's a limited lifespan for how long you're going to be able to do that, just not tell people anything. Because the spin they put on it is, we don't even tell the talent how many people are watching. We don't want them to worry about ratings. The negative part of that is, if you're making Orange is the New Black, you don't have the data to go in and say, here's how many people watch, therefore I'm worth X.
Right.
I think that, in addition to the fact that this has just been going on for long enough now, they're starting to put out stuff where, like, for example, Netflix put something out the other day claiming that Narcos was more popular than Game of Thrones, more popular or more successful or a bigger hit or something like that. And the problem is you put stuff out like that and people start to say, prove it or stop saying things like that.
Yeah.
So I think the more they see value in the competitive nature of actually showing things that are, I don't think they're going to start telling you exactly how many people watch everything, but I think they're going to start to cough up a little bit more than they've been coughing up for the benefit of the shows where they think it will help.
And as you say, one of the reasons they haven't felt any kind of pressure to do that is because showrunners, actors, writers are in this honeymoon period with Netflix, calling it the creative mecca what they used to call HBO.
Exactly.
It's taken over that role.
Exactly.
But as you point out, when it comes time to renegotiate contracts, that's when it's all, because you can have a creative mecca, but you also need the bottom line.
And you're competing against Amazon, which has certainly launched very successful things, Hulu.
And Hulu has really, this has been a big year for Hulu, kind of really making a bigger play. They've made a much bigger play in movies. Mm-hmm. They've introduced an ad-free service, which for a long time people were like, I would never pay for Hulu as long as you still had to watch ads. It costs a little more, but they have that. And I think once you're in competition with those folks, you have more of a reason to do that. And as Glenn said, they're in a honeymoon period, but eventually people start to want to talk about what's making money and what's not. Yeah. That doesn't last forever. It's not a model that's outside capitalism. So that's my prediction. When we come back, we will be moving on to our final segment and favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week. So stick around.
Support for NPR comes from NBC's Superstore, a new workplace comedy from a producer of The Office. TV Line says Superstore is irresistibly charming, and IGN calls the show smart. The new comedy stars America Ferrera from Ugly Betty and Ben Feldman, plus Kean Peele's Colton Dunn and Mark McKinney from Kids in the Hall. The Boston Herald says retail hell has never been so much fun. Don't miss the premiere of Superstore, Monday at 8, 7 Central, only on NBC.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is a new year coming up, but we are happy as always and sticking with our classic final segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy?
Well, because 'tis the season, a couple of very successful family gifts. I mentioned the SodaStream machine, which is quickly changing the way I consume fizz. Also, my daughter received a copy of the film Shaun of the Dead to continue in her pursuit of lots and lots and lots of scary and gory movies. She is a big horror movie fan. And my mother had the idea of sitting her down to watch Shaun of the Dead, which she proclaimed, my daughter, not my mother, proclaimed the best movie ever made. And so trying to steer her in the direction of gory, horror-driven things that have a sense of humor and a brain is going well. The other thing is, speaking of 'tis the season, it is the year-end list-making season and so forth. We will provide a link on the blog, but I have assembled my year-end. For my friends, I always put together these two-disc mixes of my favorite songs of the year, and this year I'm putting it on Spotify and sharing it with all of you lovely people. So, like I said, we'll throw that link, but a year of wonderful music distilled down to 40 songs just for y'all.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
A coffee table book came out in October called Will Eisner, Champion of the Graphic Novel by Paul Levitz, put out by Abrams Comics Arts. They do great things. Will Eisner is the comics artist and writer known for The Spirit, character of The Spirit, and also for a book called A Contract with God, which is recognized widely as the first graphic novel as we can right now understand that term to be used. Maggie Thompson, I can hear your well actually. Put it away. I understand that there's controversy here, but as we now think of this term graphic novel, Contract with God was among the first. And there have been other biographies of Will Eisner, certainly, but this one contains new images that haven't been published before, things from his past that he's done. And it also really focuses on his championing, advocating for the graphic novel as a storytelling format that can tell adult, rounded, nuanced stories. So it's great and perfect for Under the Tree, if the tree is still up. Will Eisner, Champion of the Graphic Novel.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Kat Chow, what is making you happy this week, ma'am?
Today I got to see Matt Thompson, formerly of NPR and also Pop Culture Happy Hour. He stopped by NPR, and it was great just seeing him, even for a brief moment. And also another thing that's making me happy is another entry into the Toasts' If X Were Your Y series. Mm-hmm. So Nicole Chung, who also wrote earlier this year If John Cho Were Your Boyfriend, did another one featuring If Daniel Henney, who is another Asian American American actor, or your boyfriend. He is of Criminal Minds, Beyond Borders, and then also a very like niche K-drama. So he's kind of minor, but they're just hilarious. One of the examples that she gave was, if Daniel Henney were your boyfriend, the two of you would be able to have entire silent conversations across a crowded room, thanks in large part to his highly expressive eyebrows, accompanied by the creepiest looping gif of him making like a furrowed expression and then also unfurrowing because it's a gif in a really unnatural way. Worth checking out. Like, who wouldn't love that? And so that was just another gem.
Thank you very much, Kat Chow. What I chose for what is making me happy this week, as this podcast is released, we are a couple of days away from the January 3rd return of Downton Abbey for its final season on U.S. television. I hear you out there, all of you people who say, don't be ridiculous, I've already watched it. I've watched it illegally, I've watched it piratedly, I've watched it by quote-unquote flying to London. Mm-hmm. But it's coming back on U.S. television for the final season. Some people out there will say, who cares? I stopped watching that show a long time ago. I care is who cares. I still care what happens to Lady Mary. I don't particularly care whether Bates ends up in jail.
Oh, God.
They've lost me on that part. But there are still plenty of things on that show that I care about very much, and I have loved it for a long time, and it has been a great pleasure to me, and I look forward to seeing it again for its final season. So for me, what is making me happy is the return of Downton Abbey for its final season. I make no apologies. Thank you very much, British people and PBS, for bringing it to me. And that is what is making me happy this weekend. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Kat at Kat Chow. That's KATCHOW. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATCIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music to which you are ringing in the new year right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. NPR podcasts have got you covered this holiday season, regardless of your mood or interests. We've got insights on politics and science, surprising interviews to share, discuss, and debate, year-end lists gathering the best in music, movies, and books, and of course, we've got a world of storytelling for when you just need to escape for some alone time. Discover your new favorite podcasts now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.